Here in Payton City twice before in gospel meetings, but I need to do it about every week to be able to fix the names of everyone in mind where I don't forget them. So I want you to forgive me for not being able to remember your names, but I will remember your faces. But I also find that now, after all these years, people, places in my memory sort of run together. And I can't remember whom I saw where and so on, but I surely have always enjoyed being here with you. I've enjoyed my time with you. You're a delightful group of people to be with, and I surely do enjoy that. So I'm looking forward to the week of being with you. And this morning, I'm going to talk about a lesson, in fact, this morning, and then later this morning, and then tonight, three lessons that are not actually related to what I'll be teaching during the week. But generally, of course, they are, because everything in the Bible is related. But this morning, I want to talk to you, make a comparison between the old law and the new law. I want to make a comparison between the law of Moses, the way it was given, and the significance that it occupies during the whole Old Testament period, and then the New Testament, and the significance that it occupies also. So I hope this lesson will be beneficial to you, and I really want you to listen very carefully. I invite you to turn to the passages. We're going to begin our study in the book of Deuteronomy, a couple of passages in the book of Deuteronomy. And these passages, the first one is found in Deuteronomy 18. In Deuteronomy 18, verses 21 and 22. In this passage, in this chapter, Moses is talking about the fact that God is going to provide guidance for his people. Now, they're not going to have to seek for guidance from witchcraft, necromancy, or the various means that men sometimes use to try to find out what is going to be, because God is going to send them a prophet. In fact, Moses says in Deuteronomy 18:15 that a prophet shall the Lord your God send unto you like unto me, to him shall ye hearken in all things. Now ultimately, that ultimate prophet was Jesus. But the promise also had to do with other prophets that God was going to send along from time to time. These prophets would be inspired of God, and therefore God's people would not need to seek for knowledge and so on from other sources. He would provide them with the knowledge that they needed. Now look in verses 21 and 22. In those verses, Moses is saying, now you will ask yourself, how can we know whether this prophet is from God and so on? And so he made the point that if the prophet tells you something and that thing does not come to pass, then that prophet is a false prophet. He has spoken presumptuously. Now ponder that for a moment. Here is a man who comes forward and he pretends to be a prophet. He claims to be a prophet. Now, how can you evaluate whether he actually is a prophet or not? Well, one thing, if the thing that he says does not come to pass, then he is not a true prophet. Now, you might think, well, that pretty well settles it. Well, no, it really doesn't. It settles one thing, and that is that if a man claims to be a prophet of God and he says something and what he says proves to be untrue or it doesn't come to pass, then you don't need to make any further investigation about that matter. That man is a false prophet. End of the matter. But now turn to Deuteronomy 13. It is in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 and 2, that the plot begins to thicken, as the saying goes. Because in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 and 2, Moses poses the situation where here comes a man claiming to be a prophet, and he gives a sign, and the sign comes to pass. But this man is seeking to draw people away to worship other gods. So here is a man who has come posing as a prophet, and he is actually teaching and encouraging the people to worship false gods. He gives a sign, and the sign comes to pass. And yet Moses says, you are not to pay attention to that prophet. Now, I hope that in your mind, the same question is already coming up that came up in my mind and made me really begin looking at this idea and seeking to understand this. Let me pose the question for you so that you will be sure and think about it in the way that I want us to think about it this morning for a while. God Himself used signs to show that it was He speaking. Now you know that, don't you? All through the Old Testament, all through the New Testament, God would use signs. He would appear miraculously. His spokesman would do miracles. These were all for the purpose of verifying their claim that they were speaking for God and that they were speaking from God. So they would do signs. The signs would prove that they were speaking from God. But here is a man that Moses is talking about in Deuteronomy 13, 1 and 2, who is going to do a sign, and the sign is going to come to pass, but because of what the man is preaching, his message is to be rejected. So why is it that the sign of this prophet, even though it comes true, is to be rejected, whereas the signs that Moses and others like that did were counted as being valid and genuine and significant? So I got to thinking about that. And out of that thought came some things that I want to share with you this morning. In the first place, go back to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Chapter 4. And here we begin to see the solution already. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 32 through 35, Moses is, again, preaching. That's what Deuteronomy is. It is a series of speeches that Moses gave to the people over about 5 weeks prior to his death and before their crossing over into the land of Canaan. So in Deuteronomy 4, 32 through 35, Moses says, "You just think about all the times that are past." He says, has there ever been anything like this to occur? He talks about a God who spoke out of the fire. This would be God as He spoke from Mount Sinai, as He spoke from the top of the mountain. He spoke to the people. Has there ever been a time like this in all the history of the world where a God spoke out of the fire? And then he goes on and says, have you ever known of another situation where a God actually went to a foreign country and took a people out of that country to make them His own people? What Moses is saying in those verses in Deuteronomy chapter 4 is that when God manifested Himself to Israel in the Old Testament, when He manifested Himself to Israel at Mount Sinai, that was in connection with such a great outpouring of miracles and signs that the things that were said by God at that time are not to be set aside. They are not to be easily set aside, and that would be like, here comes a man, and maybe he can draw a rabbit out of a hat. By deceit, by trickery, he gives a sign, the sign comes to pass. How many signs was that? One. And so you mean that if one man comes along and he gives some sign, that then you're going to be willing to set aside all that God did at Mount Sinai? Now then, that's the thing that we have to start with here. And let me remind you of something. The relationship of God with Israel actually began a long time before Israel existed itself. Because when God called Abraham, He called Abraham to be that special one. And He made certain promises to Abraham regarding his descendants and his family and so on. And from Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, came this nation of Israel. And Israel had been down there in Egypt, had been slaves for all these years. And in the time of God's own choosing, He sent Moses down to bring the children of Israel up out of the land. And when Moses went in before Pharaoh, and he said, thus saith the Lord, let my people go. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should let His people go? I don't know the Lord, and I will not do what He says. As a friend of mine put it, Pharaoh said, I don't know the Lord. So Moses signed him up for a 10-lesson course. and who the Lord was. And the Lord brought 10 plagues upon the land of Egypt. And when the last of these 10 plagues had come, then Pharaoh very energetically said, "Go, get out, take everything, don't leave a hoof behind, take everything, go." And Israel would not have been able to go had it not been for these 10 plagues that God brought upon the land of Egypt. And each of these plagues was a great sign. And so we have God doing these great signs through Moses. These were observable, these were visible signs. These were things like the water of the Nile turning to blood, frogs coming up over all the land, lice, flies, murrain of cattle, boils, hail, locusts, thick darkness, death of the firstborn. The children of Israel make their way out in the desert. They come to the edge of the Red Sea. How are they going to cross the Red Sea? You don't imagine crossing the Red Sea. You don't get up the next day and say, "Did I dream that?" See, this is the kind of sign that could not be faked. And this is the kind of sign that only God could do. And God caused the waters of the Red Sea to divide, and the children of Israel crossed over. As they made their way down to Mount Sinai, there were the waters of Marah that the people could not drink until God made it possible for them to drink those waters by showing Moses a tree or a shrub to cut down and throw into the water and make it sweet. And then one of the most amazing things about God's signs to Israel was one which occurred every day except the Sabbath. And that is when the children of Israel were without food. They called upon God. God sent them manna. And so the manna would come every day. Every day when the dew was gone, the manna would be there. So that every day the children of Israel had that visible, tangible reminder that God is taking care of us. There was the water from the rock of Rephidim. But all of those things must surely have paled in significance with what happened when the people got at Mount Sinai. God spoke to Moses and he told him to prepare the people for his coming, because God himself was going to come down and talk to the people. And by the way, in Deuteronomy chapter 5, the record is given by Moses of that event. Now, of course, we read of that back in Exodus 19 and 20. But here, 40 years later, Moses tells of that event in Deuteronomy 5, and he tells how fearful the people were. Now, you picture yourself as being among the Israelites out there on the plain in front of Mount Sinai. And you picture on the third day, darkness settling on top of the mountain, thick clouds, lightning flashing out, the rumbling and the shaking of the earth, and then the voice of God speaking from that mountaintop, as Moses said, speaking from the fire. Has a God ever done that before? Now what you see here is that there was such an outpouring of great miracles and signs that God was wanting the people to know, "I have done this that you might know that you're dealing with the true God." So that means that as we think about what God did there at Mount Sinai, it needs to loom much larger in our thinking about the Old Testament than is commonly the case. I think that a lot of us have the idea that if you were to graph the process or the progress of God's revelation in the Old Testament, we would have a pretty well a flat line that just constantly moves along here, coming all through the Old Testament period down to the time of the New Testament. But actually, I believe that a much more accurate graph of that would be one with an enormous hump back here, a mountaintop, and then coming down to a more level. I think that that would be a far more accurate representation, because the law of Moses was given by God and it served to undergird everything else that happened in the Old Testament. So that's the thing I want you to see here. When God gave the law of Moses, he did not give that law as something that was just one installment. He didn't mean that that's just one installment in this constant revelation that he would be giving during the Old Testament period. But it was a fundamental, foundational thing that God did, and what he did there underlay all the rest of the Old Testament. Let me show you a few things here that I'm talking about. For example, in Deuteronomy 17, instructions are given in the last paragraph of Deuteronomy 17 that when there was a king who would sit upon the throne of Israel, that king was to have his own copy of what? Of the law. The law given through Moses was then to be the constant companion of the kings of Israel. And that'd be a lot later on. And it wouldn't be the idea that God was going to give them some special revelation of their own. Now here's another thing that's a very interesting point to keep in mind. We all know that obviously the revelation of God continued in the Old Testament period. After the law of Moses was given at Mount Sinai, the law, the revelation of God did continue. There can be no question about that. But the fact there would be later revelations did not make null and void that revelation which he gave at Mount Sinai. It did not. So in Deuteronomy 17, God is looking forward to a much later time, and he says that the kings of Israel are to have their own copies of the law given through Moses. And even though I'm not leaving Deuteronomy, I'm going to make a quick reference. In 1 Kings chapter 2, when Solomon takes over as king and David is giving him his last instructions from his own deathbed, one of the points that David makes to Solomon is, Solomon, you be careful to do according to that which is written in the law which was given through Moses. Now what that's showing us is that the law of Moses given back there at Mount Sinai was to be the foundation on the basis of which Solomon would rule, on the basis of which all the kings of Israel were to rule. And yet those kings came along several hundred years later. Nevertheless, the law occupies the foundation. It is the foundation of God's dealings with the Jews through all the Old Testament period. In Deuteronomy 31, Moses finishes writing the book of the law. And Deuteronomy 31 says he gave it into the hands of the priests to keep. And he also told them that every seventh year, in the year of release, they were to gather all Israel together and they were to read the law of Moses. Now that's Deuteronomy 31. Now listen, every 7 years this is to be done. Every man, woman, and child in Israel is to be gathered together and the law is to be read to them. Now every 7 years, you know, it wouldn't take long. Wouldn't take many groups of 7 years before you're beginning to rack up some time there. So you're looking out over a long period of time. God is contemplating that this law given at Mount Sinai is to continue to be the basis of his dealings with Israel. Now then turn over to Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1 in verse 8. Now this one is to me a really fascinating passage. It's fascinating on its own basis. You can make a sermon out of this one verse. But here is God now speaking to Joshua. And I want to take just a moment and remind you about Joshua. Joshua was one of the two men of the men of war who had been alive 40 years before, still in Israel. He and Caleb were the only two left. Remember that? And remember that it was because at Kadesh Barnea, when God said, okay, go up and take the land, the men of war were the ones who refused to do it. And therefore God said, all this generation of men of war will pass away, and they will not enter the land. But Joshua and Caleb did because they were faithful. They were among the spies that went up. But Joshua and Caleb were faithful, and they said, we can do it. So Joshua and Caleb are the only two of all those men left now. And now Joshua is going to take over the leadership of Israel. And so as he is preparing to take over the leadership of Israel, the verse is verse 8. And let me tell you something. Every one of you that wants to be a Bible teacher, every one of you that wants to be a man of God in any way, whether it's as an elder, a preacher, or a teacher of the Bible, let this verse be your motto. God said to Joshua, this book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. Now that book of the law means the book of the law which Moses had written. So the first point, this book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. And what that meant was that any time that Joshua spoke, instructing the people in the ways of God, it was to be this book of the law that was in his mouth. That's what he was to teach them. So that, do you see, that the basis of Joshua's instructions, the basis of his instructions to the children of Israel as he leads them, is to be the law of Moses, which God has given. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. Number two, but thou shalt meditate thereon day and night. And by the way, you ought to get a concordance sometime and look up all the verses that says has to do with meditating on the law day and night. It's really interesting how many of them there are. So I think there is a suggestion there that we need to meditate on the book of God day and night. Don't you think so? And so he's telling Joshua, you shall meditate thereon day and night. Third, that you may do according to all that is written therein. Take those three points. The book of the law, not to depart out of your mouth. That's what you're to teach. Meditate on it day and night so that it will fill your mind and heart and it'll be there. In order that you may walk according to all that is therein. And then thou shalt make your way prosperous. And then you shall find success. So Joshua is to proceed on the basis of that law. I've already mentioned 1 Kings 2 and Solomon. Let me come on to the end of this part of our study by referring you to Malachi. Malachi. You recognize Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 4 and verse 4. Malachi 4 verse 4. Here we are at the end of the Old Testament process of revelation, because following Malachi, there are no further revelations until the time of Jesus, when it is time for Jesus to come. So look at what God tells Malachi, or tells the people through Malachi. Remember the law of Moses. Remember the law of Moses. One other point before I forget it. You know, many times today when you're dealing with people who think that, in other words, Pentecostal people, people who believe that God is still revealing His will miraculously to people today, I've found many times in dealing with people like that, that the Bible is of little significance. And if you bring up something from the Bible, they say, oh, that doesn't matter. What matters is I've got it in here. One of the points I'd like to make is that Joshua was certainly one that had it in here. Joshua was certainly one that was going to be receiving further revelations from God back there in Joshua 1. That was what was going on at that very time. But that did not discount what God had previously said. So that the law of Moses was to continue to be the basis of Joshua's study and teaching. And here at Malachi 4:4, we're finding that all during the Old Testament period, the law of Moses has continued to be the foundation of God's dealings with men. It is also interesting, which I'm not going to do, but it is interesting to look at the prophets and to see that these prophets of the Old Testament, the written prophets especially, these written prophets were not primarily in the business of revealing new things. They did reveal some new things. They did state prophecies regarding things that were to be fulfilled. But actually, the bulk of what the prophets of the Old Testament did was to preach what God had said in the law. That's actually the primary thing they did. They were inspired preachers. Now, one place you could look, which I'm not saying do it now, but make a note. Jeremiah 3, Jeremiah 7. Those would be two good chapters for you to look at where you can see a very direct dependence of Jeremiah on the book of Deuteronomy. But now I want to move to the New Testament. And what I want you to see now is keep in mind what we've said, that God gave a body of revelation called the law at Mount Sinai. And during the time of Moses, and once that was given, it served as the foundation for God's dealings with men, even during the time when revelation continued to be given. Now, coming to the New Testament, I want you to turn to Hebrews, please. The book of Hebrews. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. I think this is extremely significant with regard to the point that I'm going to make, so let's pay careful attention to it. God, having of old time spoken unto the fathers by the prophets in divers portions and in divers manners, hath at the end of these days, or hath in these last days, spoken unto us in his Son. Now, there you have a contrast. God spoke unto the fathers and the prophets, one of whom was Moses. That was in times past. In these last days, he has spoken unto us in his Son. So that the point being made here is that the last great outpouring of God's revelation is through his Son. He has spoken unto us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world, who being the effulgence of his glory and the very image of his substance, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had made purification for sin, sat down on the right hand of God. This is Jesus Christ. He is the one through whom God has spoken. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, Hebrews chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, he makes the point that therefore we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things that were spoken, lest haply we should drift away from them. For if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, now here we're looking back at the revelation of God in the Old Testament. If the revelation through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which having at the first been spoken through the Lord, here's Jesus. Here's the revelation of Jesus. What he spoke during his own lifetime. But it goes beyond what he spoke in his own lifetime. Because the writer goes on and says, was confirmed unto us by them that heard. These were the apostles. So what we're seeing in these two passages in Hebrews chapter 1, Hebrews chapter 2, is that the last great outpouring of the revelation of God was given through his Son, Jesus Christ. But that doesn't mean that it was through Jesus' own personal words. It was through Jesus' personal words, but not only through his own personal words. But it was also through the words that were spoken by those men whom he chose and sent out, the apostles. And he told those men in John 14, 26, that when the Comforter would come, he would bring to their remembrance all that Jesus had spoken unto them. John 14, 26. And in John 16, 13, he said, howbeit when he, the Spirit of truth, is come, he shall not speak from himself, but what things soever he shall hear, these shall he speak, and he shall declare unto you that which is to come. He shall guide you into all the truth. In John 20, verses 30 and 31, actually there are two gospel accounts that contain a specific purpose stated. The two are Luke and this passage in John. In Luke, it is the first few verses of the gospel account. In John, it is John 20, verses 30 and 31. Listen to these verses. Many other signs therefore did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So that John is telling us that his gospel was written that men might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that believing they may have life in his name. Luke explains that the purpose was to inform Theophilus about the events that had happened concerning the life of Jesus. And then we think of the many passages in the New Testament, such as 1 Corinthians 14, verses 37 and 38. If any man thinketh himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him take knowledge that the things that I write unto you are the commandment of the Lord. That's what Paul said his writings were. Peter spoke of the writings of Paul in 2 Peter 3, 16 and 17, and referred to them as Scripture, because he talked about false teachers who wrest the other Scriptures. In other words, what we have in the New Testament is a revelation that God gave through His Son, which is to be the foundation of His dealings with us during all this era. And we are to value them. We are to esteem them. In the same way that those Old Testament passages talked about the importance of the law of Moses. Our revelation is that law of Jesus Christ. It is the New Testament. And that New Testament is given to us to be the foundation of our conduct and the foundation of God's dealings with us throughout all this age. So it's very interesting to me to compare the two and to see that they occupy a similar relationship during their own eras, as the law of Moses did back during the time of the Mosaic law, and then in the gospel age, how the New Testament occupies this foundational position with regard to God's dealings with us, this revelation which He has given. So I hope that this study has been helpful to you. I think that a lot of it you would already know, so I wasn't telling you anything you didn't know, but perhaps we've looked at it in a way that will enhance our understanding and will give us a greater appreciation for the place and the role of the New Testament in our lives.